WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Newsweek magazine, in reviewing Kem Nunn's new novel, The Dogs of Winter, called it the greatest novel ever written about surfing. Nunn himself calls his book a Gnostic surf fable. The novel proceeds from a classic kind of hard-boiled fiction premise. The protagonist, Jack Fletcher, is a middle-aged surfer and photographer whose life has gone sour. Divorce, booze, pills, a thoroughly botched career, now reduced to taking pictures at weddings, quote, as far inland as Pomona Valley, the land of the powder blue tuxedo. Fletcher gets a second chance in life when he's suddenly asked by a big surfing magazine to accompany three surfers in finding Heart Attacks, a secret spot on Native American land in Northern California. Fletcher's there to photograph the surfers as they try to conquer the giant Heart Attacks waves. But in the process, he also falls for the wife of one of the surfers and encounters violence and death. The Dogs of Winter is Kem Nunn's fourth novel. His first, 1984's Tapping the Source, also about surfing, continues to have a strong cult following. There are surf shops in California named after the book. Kem Nunn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
As an admirer of both Dogs of Winter and Tapping the Source, I'm impressed by the fact that I find myself completely enthralled by a sport I have absolutely no interest in, which I take as a testament to your powers of description and pacing as a writer. What is it about surfing that interests you that makes it a subject rich enough to carry the weight and drama of a novel?
Well, you know, I don't know. It was something I grew up with, so it was a part of my life. And I still remember the first time I saw anybody surf. That was back in the days when you could still camp out on the beaches in Southern California. And I remember camping out with my family and another family, waking up in the morning and seeing these guys surfing at a place called Salt Creek. And it just, you know, I'd always loved the beach and loved the ocean. And when I saw somebody doing that, it just struck me that this is what these things were for. This is how you achieve some sort of communion with them. And so surfing became a part of my life at that time. And I don't know, that's part of the answer, I guess, that it was just part of my life and it was an important part of my life.
You have a real gift for being able to describe that sensation, the unique sensation, I think, of riding the waves and experiencing the waves. I wonder if I could ask you to read a description that occurs early on in the book that you have of the waves. It's on page 108.
Okay. Fletcher watched as the first wave of the set passed over the reef and began to break. At close quarters, it was an unnerving spectacle and yet a thing to behold, full of terror and fluid beauty. The amount of water involved was such that it was like watching a piece of the earth become liquid, as if in some cataclysm or at the hour of creation. The wave rose first with great mass, like a hill, but this hill was made of liquid in constant flux, and even as you watched it, it would change its form, turning itself to a long, dark wall as the face went vertical, and then beyond vertical as the crest began to feather, and finally to pitch forward, to strike the water far out in front of the face, thus creating the vaunted green room of surfing myth, the place to be if you were to be there at all, on a board at the eye of the storm, encompassed by the sound and the fury, bone dry in a place no one had ever been, or ever would be again, because when the wave was gone, the place was gone too, and would exist only in memory. Or perhaps, if the right person was there, in the right place, with the right equipment, it would exist on film, a little piece of eternity to hang on the wall.
That's Kem Nunn reading from his novel, The Dogs of Winter. In the new book, Jack Fletcher hooks up with these surfers that he's been hired to photograph, the two young guys who are sort of wild and sullen and rather stupid, and a slightly older man, a contemporary of Fletcher's who's in his 40s, Drew Harmon, who's a really fascinating character. You refer to him as the old lion, the holy ghost of professional surfing. I think at first the reader is kind of led to think that he's just a big blowhard and a bully. He's almost a caricature of an Ernest Hemingway kind of man. But as the book proceeds, we see that Harmon's a very intelligent guy with theories about everything. He's a surfing legend who's thought through the implications of the life that he's chosen. And it occurred to me that he's the man of action in the book, while Fletcher is an observer, much less of a hero, yet Fletcher's still the central character of the book. What were you trying to do with Harmon?
I've always been like any subculture. You know, surfing has, there's a refrain that runs through the book about surfers, you know, loving their stories, particularly stories that revolve around, you know, big waves and outlaws, anybody who can stay old and somehow stay in the life. And that's, you know, not untrue of the culture at large, you know, the way we pick certain people and make heroes out of them for particular reasons. And often, you know, concentrating on the good things they've done and ignoring the rest of it, or sort of letting them slide with the things that they've done that perhaps aren't so good. And, you know, over the years, I would read, sometimes there would be profiles in surfing magazines about particular people who had, you know, managed in some way to stay in the surfing life, and they were, you know, this was all presented as very great. And yet, if you knew a little bit more about the people, or if you're able even to read between the lines, you'd see that there really was another story there, you know, things that had been given up, things that had been sacrificed. So I was interested in writing a story and having this character who, you know, Jack Fletcher, the photographer, goes off in pursuit, really, of the legend. And what he discovers is the man beneath the legend. You know, he discovers the dark side of that myth, the price that this guy has paid for his, you know, status as a, you know, cult hero within this particular subculture. And but I think there's some sort of universal truths at play there, at least I would like to think so. But that was, I think, the beginning of what intrigued me about him as a character.
Yeah, it's almost set up in a kind of Great Gatsby sort of way, in that Fletcher's the sort of Nick Carraway figure who's looking at the figure of Drew Harmon and kind of analyzing him in that way, and looking at him and turning him around in his mind. When at the start of the book, when Fletcher's offered the assignment, the magazine editor says to him, "We're going to find out if you're still the one or not." And it seems to me that at that moment, the book is set up as a kind of testing for Fletcher, for this guy who's had a pretty rocky life up till then. Do you think that's true, that in a way the story is about testing Fletcher's character?
I think so. It's also, in a strange way, the book is in a way about middle life for me, about that passage from, as Jung called it, the night sea journey, you know, that passage from the first half of life into the second. And really all three male characters are sort of at that place, that, you know, that place that Jung also called the dead center, where you sort of have to figure out how to get from the first part to the next part. And so that's, in a way, that's really what's at stake for Jack Fletcher. I mean, the first part is over, and now he's got to sort of discover how to position himself for the rest of his life, for the second half of his life. So in that sense, it's a test, but it becomes a test quite different from the one that Michael Peters suggests at the beginning of the book. It becomes something, there's something more at stake than just, you know, getting his name back on the masthead of a surfing magazine.
Novelist Kem Nunn. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're talking to Kem Nunn, who's written a new novel called The Dogs of Winter. I'd be interested to know what you think of movies about surfing over the years, from those, you know, endless summer documentaries to movies like John Milius's Big Wednesday or Catherine Bigelow's movie Point Break. Have you seen any of those movies?
Yeah, I've probably seen all of them.
Uh-huh. Do you think they do surfing the sort of justice you would like them to do?
No, I think we have yet to see like a really good movie that makes use of the surfing milieu. I mean, there again, it has to be, you know, the story has to come first. It has to be a great story played out against that particular milieu. Mm-hmm. You can't do it the other way around, which Hollywood often tries to do, not only with surfing, but with any other sport, race car driving or, you know, whatever. They often, you know, feel that the milieu or the sport is enough, and then the story takes, you know, second fiddle to that, and you wind up with something that's ultimately not really very good.
So Keanu Reeves in Point Break is not a convincing surfer for you?
Well, it's, you know, that is a kind of typical example of rather than of thinking, that's a kind of classic example of Hollywood thinking about surfing, is that, well, you can't just, the surfing alone won't be enough, and you can't have just a good story played out against that milieu. In order to get people's attention, we've got to have, you know, cops and robbers in it. So you have to put these two genres together, and what you wind up with is, you know, kind of silly, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. As I talk to you, you're in Florida doing what I understand is some script doctoring on a movie being made there?
That's right.
What is that movie?
Well, this is a movie called Wild Things.
Uh-huh.
It's got Matt Dillon, Kevin Bacon, Nev Campbell. It's being directed by my friend John McNaughton,
uh-huh.
who made a movie called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Sure.
Sort of, that's his cult film, I guess.
Right. And how's that going? What's it like to be on the set of a movie doctoring a script?
Well, you know, so far it's okay. They haven't actually started shooting yet, but Mr. McNaughton is somebody that I enjoy working with quite a lot. We share similar ways of seeing the world, and, you know, we've certainly had some fun with the story. So I'm you know, it's getting to the point to where it's pretty much the ball will be in his court now, and I'm hoping that I'm hoping that he will get a good movie out of it. I think that he can.
Does that kind of writing, working on scripts, screenplays, does that sort of come with the territory as a writer in California? Is it something that you look at as a way to make money and further your time you can spend as a novelist?
Well, for a while, when I was going to school in New York, I thought that I sold Tapping the Source about the, you know, I got to Columbia, the writing program there, and about the first week I was in town, my agent sold the novel, and so a lot of people couldn't figure out why I was still hanging around the program, and I thought at that time that what I wanted to do was teach, and that I would, through some combination of published work and an advanced degree, I would probably, you know, use some sort of teaching career to help finance the novel writing, which is, I guess, because I had known other writers that had done that. But once I actually began doing that, trying to teach, I just realized that it was something I didn't much like to do. I didn't want to put the time and energy you have to put into it to really teach full time. It wasn't feeding my work in the proper way. So I had an agent out in Hollywood at that time, and was having lunch with her one day and sort of complaining about the fact that I had to teach. And she said, "Well, why don't you write a screenplay, and then I'll sell it, and you won't have to teach anymore." So I took her up on that and took a month and ground out an original screenplay, which we did manage to sell, and I've pretty much been going back and forth between the novels and the screenplay since then. That was in about 1988.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Kem Nunn, whose new novel is called The Dogs of Winter.